History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask some questions and then invest enough time to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend marks the 78th anniversary of a day that changed the world. The radio station you're listening to right now may have carried these words from President Harry Truman on August 6, 1945.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. That was because we wished in the first attack to avoid, in so far as possible, the killing of civilians. But that attack is only a warning of things to come. If Japan does not surrender, bombs will have to be dropped on her war industries, and unfortunately, thousands of civilian lives will be lost. I urge Japanese civilians to leave industrial cities immediately and save themselves from destruction. I realized the tragic significance of the atomic bomb. Its production and its use were not lightly undertaken by this government, but we knew that our enemies were on the search for it. We know now how close they were to finding it. And we knew the disaster which would come to this nation and to all peace-loving nations, to all civilization, if they had found it first. That is why we felt compelled to undertake the long and uncertain and costly labor of discovery and production. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. Having found the bomb, we have used it. We have used it against those who attack us without warning at Pearl Harbor, against those who have starved and beaten and executed American prisoners of war, against those who have abandoned all pretense of obeying international laws of warfare. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us.
We know that, unfortunately, a second bomb would have to be dropped on Nagasaki before Imperial Japan surrendered. It's always amazed me that President Truman didn't even know about the Manhattan Project until after President Franklin D. Roosevelt died in April of 1945. The dawn of the nuclear era and the events and decisions before, during, and after the deployment of the atomic bomb have drawn renewed interest and even debate with the release of the Hollywood blockbuster Oppenheimer, centering around the legendary physicist who spearheaded those efforts. Over the years, we've heard plenty of perspectives about the bomb here on Hometown Heroes, from sailors aboard the ill-fated USS Indianapolis who delivered components of it to Tinian, to Marines there on that island who helped unload the precious cargo. Of course, we've heard from people who visited Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the immediate aftermath of those devastating days, even a pilot who saw the Hiroshima blast from miles away while flying his own B-29 bombing mission. And of course, we've heard from countless World War II veterans who've told us they firmly believe the atomic bomb saved their lives by preventing the planned invasion of Japan and the mind-blowing number of casualties that would have resulted on both sides. I hadn't planned on going to see this new 3-hour movie, Oppenheimer. I knew it definitely wasn't a family film, and I'm not here to tell you you should or shouldn't see it. But a headline on my news feed got my attention. It said, Oppenheimer film reignites debate over whether the atomic bomb was necessary. I knew there was one person whose perspective I had to get because I knew he was one of, if not the last surviving member of the 509th Composite Group, which had the responsibility of actually delivering the bomb. If you're a longtime Hometown Heroes listener, you may remember Norris Jernigan. He turned 98 in June, but he's still driving, still singing in his church choir in Visalia, California, and still traveling to places like the Mid-Atlantic Air Show in Reading, Pennsylvania, Wendover Field in Utah, where he first took on the burden of secrecy that surrounded this project. He's even been to the Trinity site in New Mexico where the bomb was tested, and he has the sand turned to glass called Trinitite as proof. I decided to call up Norris, and if he was up for seeing this film, then I would be too. So this week, we went and watched Oppenheimer. The other folks in the theater had no idea the guy with the World War II veteran hat on is one of our last living links to this chapter of history. I don't think we'll have any spoilers here if you haven't seen the film, but I thought you might be interested in Norris Jernigan's reaction to Oppenheimer, fresh after sitting through 3 hours of it.
Well, I think just seeing him literally crucified the way they did, just to whittle him down to nothing, when the guy was really a genius. Weird, no question about that, but weird. But as far as the movie goes, I think there were a few explicit scenes that didn't necessarily need to be in there to tell the story of Oppenheimer. He was a brilliant person. He had his idiosyncrasies, and heavens knows, people resented the attention he got and the popularity he won. And some of them, I think, were out to cut him down. So it was kind of, but that's the way it happened. So all in all, the guy that played Oppenheimer, I thought, did a good job depicting him, because it was he depicted pretty well the character of Oppenheimer. Never had the privilege of meeting the man, but we knew about him because our part of the Manhattan Project was delivery of the bomb, but nothing to do with the development of it. So all of this I learned about Oppenheimer after the fact.
And as they showed the buildup of Los Alamos and everything that was happening there, did you find yourself thinking about what you might have been doing at some of those same time periods in the lead up to Hiroshima?
Oh, yeah. We were in training. Well, we went into training. The 509th Composite Group was activated on December 17th, 1944, and we went into extensive training. But actually, our 393rd Bomb Squadron, of which I served, we were activated in the spring of 1944 and had completed all the overseas training, and we're waiting for overseas orders when orders came through sending us to Wendover, and we found out when we got there that we had been selected as a top squadron to be the bomb squadron of the 509th Composite Group.
And I know you've always told me about, you know, the only way it was referred to was as the gadget, and the film held to that. On the other side of this thing, in Los Alamos and wherever they were, they referred to the gadget too.
Yes, that's right. We called it the gadget most of the time, or the gimmick, one or the other, back and forth. Never referred to it as an atomic bomb until after the Hiroshima drop.
You know, one thing that struck me, you've told me before about, you know, the secrecy required where you were. The film captures the secrecy that was supposed to be in effect at Los Alamos and potential flaws in that too. But I was just really struck by the timeline, even to the point here in mid-July, they don't even know if it's going to work, and they have the Trinity test, and you're already on Tinian at that point with the squadron, correct?
That's correct, yes. We arrived over there, I arrived the end of May, and our flight crews and all the rest of the people that flew over arrived by the middle of June. And in July, our crews, flight crews, started flying practice bombs, missions to Japan using 10,000-pound TNT bombs to experience the dropping of this huge, heavy bomb, because the size of it was enormous. It just barely fit up in the bomb bay of the B-29.
And I want to get your perspective on, you know, the morality of the bomb. You've been asked about that many times over the years, and this film kind of reignites that debate. But, you know, I'm just struck by the unknowns along the way. The guys that have invested years of their life and billions and all the brilliant minds, they don't know if it's going to work. Then once they do know it does work and they hope it's going to work, when they drop it for real, they still need to get it there. And you have the Indianapolis, who delivers these components and then gets sunk right afterwards in the biggest naval tragedy of all time, and then the actual bomb with the guys that you knew, and then they put some of this weight on their shoulders too. You ever think about that, how the chain of events? I mean, it's a chain reaction explosion that changed the world, but the chain of events that had to have everything go right for it to go down the way it did?
Yeah, it was really mind-boggling how quickly they developed that thing. When we went overseas, we didn't know that the thing had not been brought to the point of being tested yet, even. When the test was successful, they used a plutonium bomb for that test. The bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima was a uranium bomb, and it had never been tested. That was the test. I guess we just had faith that the bomb would get there eventually, but we were getting a little impatient. By the end of July, you know, we began to wonder, well, are these TNT 10,000-pound bombs what were talked about all this time? Our group intelligence officer said, no, not yet, just wait. And so it was right after that then. Things started developing, and all of a sudden missions were planned to use this new secret weapon. And we had been told originally that our squadron and the group would be handling a new secret weapon that, if successful, should shorten the war by at least 2 years. That's what we were looking forward to and expecting. And when the first one was dropped, we were about ready to pack and get ready to come home. We thought that would be it, but it was not. So the second one was dropped. After the second one was dropped, two flight crews were dispatched back to the United States to be on hand to start shuttling the bombs over by air to get them there. They felt they could produce one for us at least one a month, at least. There were other targets that would have gone also. The third bomb was ready and ready to be brought over to us. I understand it actually got loaded on one of the B-29s. To come over, and they were in flight, but they had not left the limits of the United States yet, and the Japanese surrendered, so that flight was aborted. The third bomb did arrive over at Tinian.
Every time I have the privilege of catching up with Norris Jernigan, I'm so impressed all over again. We're going to come back around at the end of the show to his reflections after watching this new film, Oppenheimer, centered around the world-changing event that took place 78 years ago this weekend on August 6th, 1945, when that bomb called Little Boy was released from the Enola Gay over Hiroshima. The Oppenheimer film captures how much went into that from a scientific perspective, how uncertain it all was, how some of those physicists actually feared it could set off an incessant chain reaction that would destroy the entire world. It shows the rapid construction of Los Alamos and much of the big picture. But Norris Jernigan's personal story gives us another view. He was one of many who would be sworn to secrecy and have that secrecy tested under various means of surveillance. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you can find a photo of Norris sticking his young face out of the cockpit window of the most famous B-29 in history, the Enola Gay. We'll hear about his connection to that plane, but his inspiration for leaving high school after his junior year to enlist in the Army Air Corps was the dream of becoming a pilot himself.
Well, went into active duty and was sent to Shepherd Field, Texas for the Army basic training, because back then the Air Force was part of the Army. It was right. A division of the Army. Took my basic training there and then went on to the next step of the cadet program. Was sent to Denver and enrolled in Denver University for a semester. And that's where we had our first flying lessons. It was some small private field near Denver. I think his name was Hayden Field, but I'm not really positive about that anymore. But had my 10 hours of flight instruction there. Then, after the semester was ended, came time for our school squadron to be sent to a classification center to decide whether we qualified for further pilot training or whether we would go to navigator school or bombardier school or somewhere else. Well, when we got to, it was in Santa Ana, California. When we got there, we checked daily to see what the list looked like, where we would go. The pilot list, the bombardier list, and the navigator list wasn't growing very fast, but the somewhere else list was. One day there was my name on the somewhere else, and so that was the end of my cadet training. We wondered why, because about 2/3 of my school squadron was eliminated.
Wow.
The reason they gave us was that they were gaining a surplus of aviation students to go on to the next step. So, you know, in the military, you just can't have people sitting around doing nothing. So we were eliminated from the program to free up the backlog of people waiting for further training.
The time when you were in the cadet program, when you actually got to fly, What was that like for you, and what were you flying?
Piper Cubs.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I had never been up in an airplane before. That first takeoff, it was just so exciting, you know. About the second or third lesson, they switch around their instructors. I had a woman pilot instructor. And in the old Piper Cub, they had what they called the Gosport. It was the communications, the intercom system, mm-hmm. which was really almost like the old can with a string to the other can. It was a tube connected to just like funnels that you would talk into. And started down the runway, and she said, get on that right rudder, get on that right rudder, get on that right rudder. She got to the high pitch, and I got so confused. I hit the left rudder, and we went out across the field. I thought, oh, boy, I'm washed out of this, too, now. Anyhow, we circled around, got on the runway again, and made a perfect takeoff. So I redeemed myself, but I don't know why I got so confused that I would go, I knew right from left, but that high-pitched screaming, get on that right rudder, get on that right rudder. Because you had to ride the right rudder because of the torque. You uh-huh. drift to the left. To stay on the runway, you had to stay on that rudder. That was exciting. Then you had somebody come in that you didn't even know that was check you out and made a perfect takeoff, redeemed myself again. But I was, you know, I was crushed when I got washed out of the program because, you know, you make such a big thing back home about you're going to become a pilot. I was going to fly a B-17, the biggest airplane they had at that time. And now tell them, well, I'm a airplane mechanic or I'm a truck driver, but you know, ego enters into it, I guess. But anyhow, it was tough being washed out of the program.
And little did you know that you would end up with a lifelong connection to an even bigger plane, a B-29,
yes.
Probably the most famous B-29 of all time.
Absolutely. And when we first were cut off into squadrons, we became the squadrons for the 504th Bomb Group. And they were training for overseas duty, and they call them a tactical unit, which means they're actually seriously training for overseas duty. We, at first, didn't have any B-29s. They were using B-17s to begin their training. And then when the first B-29 showed up, I just couldn't believe what a huge aircraft that was. Of course, now it's very small compared to what's in the air now. But then the B-29 started arriving, and so they transitioned into the B-29. And the 393rd Bomb Squadron was really making great headway in their training. We started our training in the spring of 1944, and by the end of August, all of the squadrons, especially the 393rd, was complete with their training. They were ready to go overseas. All of a sudden, orders came through transferring the 393rd Bomb Squadron away from the 504th and sending us to Wendover Field, Utah. Well, never heard of Wendover Field because I'd never been there before, but anyhow, we got to Wendover, and what a cultural shock that was out there on the salt flats, away from everything. 120 miles west of Salt Lake City. The little town of Wendover was nothing. It was just a small casino and then a small state line hotel was all that was there, really, and a few citizens.
And there was a reason they wanted you all in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly, and we found that out later. Well, about the second day we were there, the enlisted men, I understand the officers were pulled into one of the theaters and briefed, and the enlisted men in our squadron, we were told to assemble out in front of the orderly room. This lieutenant colonel hopped up on the back of a truck so he could see everybody and said, all right, men, gather around, I want to talk to you. So he said, introduced himself, he says, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Paul Tibbetts, and I want you to know that you've been brought here for a purpose. You're going to become part of an organization that's going to be handling a new secret weapon that, if successful, should shorten the war by at least 2 years. Now, it's top secret, high security. You're not to talk to anybody. You're not to tell anybody where you're stationed. You're not to talk to anybody about what you're doing. You're not supposed to talk to each other. So I want you now to all go on a two-week furlough. Go home, get rested up, come back, because we're going to go into an intense training program and get ready to go overseas. Well, of course, we were so excited to find out we were going to be something special. But he stressed again, remember, top secret, security is high, so don't tell anybody anything. So we left to go on a two-week leave, but what we didn't know, he wasn't concerned about us getting rested up. It was a test. to see if anybody could keep their mouth shut. Some of the guys, when they got home, had telegrams waiting for them to report back to the base immediately. And they found out when they got back to the base, they had just casually mentioned something to somebody about where they were stationed or going to be involved in something special or whatever, whatever they talked about. There was one story that was circulated, and we never could find out whether it was true or not, but it certainly made an impression on us that they really meant business about this security. It seems that one of the guys that was going on leave, while he was waiting to get his bus, train, or airplane, wherever it was, decided to go in the bar and have a drink while he was waiting. So he's sitting at this bar, and a Catholic priest came in and sat down beside him. And, of course, he struck up a conversation. "I see, my son, you're in the service." "Yes." "Where are you stationed?" "Oh, we're out at Wendover." "Wendover? What in the world are you doing there?" "Well, we're not sure. It's some top secret project we're going to be involved in." "Aha, yeah. Okay." So he went on home, and he had a telegram waiting for him. When he got back to the base, he was met by the so-called Catholic priest, who was in a business suit, was part of FBI security. We never knew who it was, and maybe it was nobody. Maybe it was just a story that was circulated to catch our attention, which it certainly did, because we realized that they meant business. You didn't know who you were talking to when you left that base.
Was it hard for you to keep that secret? Were there times you were tempted?
Oh, heavens, yes. But fortunately, I somehow or other kept it.
And if he hadn't, he wouldn't have had his connection to the history that unfolded 78 years ago this weekend. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, more on this 98-year-old's connection to the atomic bomb, and before we're done, a few final reflections after his viewing of the new film Oppenheimer. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.